Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I know. I would not have gone a minute more without adding you the second I saw you.
I was going to say, I would be really insulted if you don't add me as a friend on Skype.
How messed up would that be?
Well, I don't think I got added. My feelings are hurt.
What is wrong with you guys? Of course you got added. You got added yesterday.
I did?
Before Jamie.
Oh, shit. Guess who's...
Yep.
I'll ask you all the tough questions today, Brad. Hi, everyone. I'm Jamie.
I'm Amy, and this is Clever. All right, today we've got Mr. Brad Ascalon on the show. He's a product designer specializing in furniture, lighting, and packaging, among other consumer products. He was born outside of Philly and comes from a noteworthy lineage of creatives, which you'll hear all about when we talk. He detoured through the music industry before deciding to study industrial design at Pratt.
Before the ink was even dry on his master's diploma, Wallpaper Magazine named him one of the 10 most wanted emerging designers in the world. Since then, he's worked with brands such as Design Within Reach, Lean Rosé, Council, Other, L'Oreal, and Restoration Hardware, just to give you an idea.
He's exhibited his work globally and racked up a lot of press in all the major magazines. Plus, his band Footsteps won the Cherry Hill, New Jersey East High School Battle of the Bands back in the mid-90s. Let's get the story from Brad.
My name is Brad Ascalon. I am an industrial designer and furniture designer based in Manhattan. I do what I do because I think there's this need for creative people to put their passions into the world. I think whether you're an artist, a musician, a chef, or a designer, it's kind of this drug, this rush, you know, where your ideas are let loose in some tangible form and you want the world or some small part of the world to appreciate it or utilize it in some way. That's the reason most, I think, creatives do what they do. But the other thing that I get out of what I do is when I'm working with my clients, factories, brands around the world, this process of bringing ideas into the world alongside with them, some of whom I've spent hundreds of hours with, aligning our ideas, the direction of a project, etc. It builds this relationship that's, I think, unattainable in any other way. And at the end of the day, we do need relationships. And one of the reasons I love doing what I do is that I've made friends around the world through my craft.
Yeah, we met.
Yeah. Exactly.
And when we met, we found out that we are both from the same little town in southern New Jersey called Cherry Hill, but you were on the east side and I was on the west side. You went to east and I went to west, which is funny because they're like rival schools.
Yeah, but we were also like less than a mile away from each other. I was like on the border of east and west.
Yeah, so was I. Yeah, they were telling me like I could pick maybe which high school I wanted to go to because the bus from both schools came through our neighborhood. You know, I'd like to go back to that time and just ask you to talk a little bit about what your childhood was like and your family dynamic. Do you have siblings? Was it traditional mom, dad, picket fence, dog?
Yeah. It was mom, dad, picket fence, two brothers, no dog. It was a pretty standard nuclear suburban family that I grew up with. I was in the middle of three boys. I grew up with parents who were always unbelievably supportive and nurturing and kind of pushed us to be individuals and think our minds and do what we felt was right, explore kind of our options in life, self-expression, art. And, you know, I grew up with a father, a grandfather, an uncle, and an aunt all being artists. And so that creative engagement from their end was kind of unavoidable, you know, in a way. We were surrounded by abstract paintings and sculpture and beautiful mid-century modern furniture. And, you know, my friends grew up with framed museum posters or, like, even worse, paintings of dogs playing poker, you know. And I grew up in an incredibly creative environment with amazing inspiration all around me.
Tell us more about this creative family. Your grandfather, what was his gig?
He was born in Hungary. And when he was 15 years old, his parents refused to allow him to be an artist. And so he checked out. He left them. He went and did his thing on his own. He traveled to Belgium and Italy to study sculpture and art, eventually landed in Israel and founded a decorative arts company called Paul Bell, designing decorative objects, candle holders, vases. In fact, in some circles, he's considered to be the father of Israeli Art Deco.
Oh, cool.
Quite an inspirational story and an inspirational creative figure. But I wasn't very close to him until he saw that I started getting into the visual arts. I was always into music growing up, and I guess he didn't care too much for that. When he saw me starting to paint, I think he realized I've got some of his blood in me.
Let me wrap my head around your dynamic a little bit more. Is this grandfather your father's father or your mother's father?
Yeah, so this is my father's father. And eventually he landed in the U.S. He lived between L.A. and New York. In the 70s, he founded Ascalon Studios with my dad. And to this day, my father still runs it along with my older brother. And they create large-scale installation art, mostly in stained glass, mosaics, metal for public spaces, for religious institutions. So this was my childhood. This was my after-school job. This was my apprenticeship. And from the two of them, I learned more than anything the importance of craft, the importance of materials, the sacredness and responsibility of the resources that we use.
Let me ask you something. A lot of times kids are sort of pressured to do something a little bit more security-oriented than, let's say, the creative arts. Did you feel the opposite? Did you feel pressure to go into the creative arts?
No, I felt the same pressure that everybody else felt. You know, my father wanted me to become a doctor or a lawyer.
Was he steering you away from a lofty goal of something that was not necessarily a very secure profession?
Well, yeah, he struggled, you know. He struggled for a long time until he kind of found his groove, and he didn't want the same for me.
Sure.
Yeah, so he was obviously looking out for me.
So was there a push-pull there, like a real celebration of the creative arts and yet a conflict over, I want the best for my son, I don't want him to struggle like I do?
No conflict. I just think the two worked hand in hand. He and my mother's wanted me to be a well-rounded individual. So, you know, they weren't going to fault me if I chose to go into the arts. They wanted me to do my thing and be as well-rounded as I could, I guess.
And your aunt and uncle that were both creative artists, were they also on your father's side?
Yeah.
Okay. And then how does your mom factor into this? Is she creative as well?
She's creative in her own ways, but she's worked with my father for years. You know, she ran the books and was the office support that he needed because he's the opposite. It's like whereas my business is kind of part being creative, part running a business, he's only thinking about the art and the fabrication of it. So my mom really was there as the other end of the spectrum.
The practical side.
Yeah, a little more practical, yeah.
So you discovered painting and your grandfather took a shine to you, but you were also into music. So let's talk about your creative outlets as an adolescent when everybody else is, I don't know, trying to figure out how to get with the opposite sex or, you know, establish their identity. What were you doing?
When I was in second grade, my friend down the street was moving to Florida with his family, and they were selling this old ratty piano that was sitting in their basement collecting dust for years. And my parents just, for some reason, dreamed that one of their three boys would learn how to play the piano. So they bought the piano. They literally rolled it a third of a mile down the road, lugged it into our house, and it's been sitting in our house ever since. I took lessons from maybe third grade on, third and fourth grade, fifth grade, and I hated it. I never practiced. It was just a waste of my time. So I quit. You know, against my parents' wishes, I just couldn't do it anymore. But the day I quit, I played an hour or two a day, and I haven't stopped since.
What does that say?
I hate structure.
Yeah.
I don't like being told what to do. I don't.
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, I can't even read sheet music. You know, I always learn through listening, experimenting, exploring on my own, and just kind of creating my own rules and learn how to play without any kind of structure, strategy, or thought process. Just like, let's learn this thing that's in front of us. You know, what do the white keys do? What do the black keys do? How do they combine? And how do I make something that just emotionally resonates with me? You know, it was never about other people. And so from an early age, I was writing music and playing all the time. And eventually, eighth grade, I was in a family trip and snagged my older brother's guitar and took it with me, bought a chord book and started learning guitar. And once I started playing the guitar, I went from being into sports and being into, you know, hockey and whatever the neighborhood kids were doing to playing music, you know, being in bands, writing songs.
Tell me about your bands. Did you guys do Battle of the Bands in high school or anything like that?
We won Battle of the Bands.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Yeah. My senior year.
Your band was called?
Oh, my goodness. It sounds like a Christian rock band, but I promise you it wasn't. It was called Footsteps.
Oh, that's right. You told me that once.
It does sound like a Christian rock band, but what was your sound?
Well, in high school, it was just a bunch of covers. We played these medleys of songs that made absolutely no sense together. It was like, let's combine The Who and Journey and Green Day and make a, you know, a medley out of it. But a couple years later, we kind of regrouped with some additional members of the band. And then we actually played for a good 3-4 years, recorded a couple albums. We opened up for Chicago once.
What?
Yeah, we started to have a little groove going. And even then, our sound wasn't defined because, you know, I was into everything from blues rock to Blur. And my bass player was into jazz and my drummer was into classic rock. And the other guitarist was into Poison and glam rock. And our singer was into a singer-songwriter. So it was just such a hodgepodge. But, you know, we made it work, even though one song to the next on our album would be like two completely different bands and two completely different genres.
Did you tour playing small clubs and stuff, or did you just stick local?
Philly was our, you know, stomping ground, but we played a lot in New York City and Manhattan. We drove up to Columbus, Ohio, and we kind of, wherever we can get a gig, we played, you know. It was fun. It was a great time to be doing that. It was like middle of college. It was great.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about college because you're so creative with music and have such an interest in painting and the arts, but you ended up doing undergrad at Rutgers in communication. Can you talk about how you ended up doing that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rutgers was where you're supposed to go if you lived in New Jersey, and I'm surprised you didn't go there, Jane.
My husband went to Rutgers.
See, what town from New Jersey is he from?
Marlton.
There you go.
Yep.
And that's where you're supposed to go. That's where my older brother went, you know, in-state tuition, why not? But I had a hard time there. I had good friends, but education-wise, it was pretty rough. I came into the school, you know, referencing our conversation earlier, I wanted to do the opposite of what my father did. You know, he was an artist. I wanted to go into business school just because I wanted to make my own path, you know. And for 2.5 years, I took all the prereqs for business and statistics, micro and macroeconomic analysis, money and banking, these courses that are so far beyond me. And I was miserable. I was just squeaking by. And, you know, the only thing that kept me together academically was my music minor in music theory, which I was passionate about. And ultimately, I realized this whole business thing wasn't me. And maybe now I'd be a lot better at it. But back then, it was the last thing on my mind. It was so boring, so uninteresting. And I changed my major to communication because that's what you do when you have no idea what you want to do with the rest of your life. Right. And from that point on, it was like 4.0s until I got the hell out of Rutgers, you know?
You started a multidisciplinary design studio in 2006. And I assume that you must look back on some of those classes and be like, gosh, I'm really glad I took that, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh,
okay. Because yeah. As owning your own business, like if you're a creative person, it's great, but you still need to get the business side of it done every day, whether it's accounting or just business administrative stuff.
Any good designer, any successful design business, they've really got to have a split between their left and right brain. And fortunately, you know, I did get a lot of that, not necessarily how to run a business, but how to organize the business, how to kind of strategize moving forward. A lot of that I gained from some classes I took, but then from, you know, my first jobs out of school, which were pre-designed for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You were in advertising and also the music industry. What did you do, and talk about those experiences?
Yeah, I always wanted to be in the music industry. That was the dream, you know, not necessarily performing, but just being around it and working in it. And my first gig out of college was for a boutique ad agency that did live entertainment, Broadway shows, things like that. And I thought that would be, you know, a nice segue into the industry somehow through networking. And I hated it. I was there for about 15 months and my direct supervisor left and somebody came in to take the position that I was preparing for and I had to train him.
Ew.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I had to train him to take my job. Funny enough, I ran into him recently. His partner went to high school with me and graduated with me and he's like the greatest guy. But back then, I kind of resented the fact that I had to teach this guy the ropes of the position that I was shooting for. So eventually I left and I got a job at Atlantic Records and I was doing marketing for kind of their alternative genres, jazz, electronic, classical, minimal, avant-garde music, all the things I loved. And the job was amazing. My bosses were great. It was a dream job until 9/11.
What happened?
Well, what happened during 9/11?
No.
You don't know that story.
No, please. What happened to your job at Atlantic Records after 9/11?
No shock. This wasn't the division that was the big moneymaker. You know, it mm-hmm. wasn't their pop genre. It wasn't sustainable. And my whole division just disappeared. It was the first to get laid off in that company.
Yeah, everybody had to shrink and tighten up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It was a scary time.
It was. And so, you know, the industry was kind of shaky for a long time.
You were living in New York at that time.
I was living in New York at that time.
And you got laid off.
I was laid off. I was out of work for about 4 or 5 months. And then eventually I got a job at Elektra Records, which, you know, every stereotype you hear about people in the music industry, without overgeneralizing, you know, it's a big group of horrible people. And that made me hate an industry that I only ever wanted to love.
That's a bummer because it sounds like you had a great experience at Atlantic.
Yeah, I did. I did.
So did that totally turn you off from the music industry? And is that why you pivoted?
Yeah, completely. I kind of had this quarter life crisis. I left Elektra with no plan, no strategy, nothing. I just couldn't do it. So yeah, quarter life crisis. What the hell am I going to do with my life? And, you know, I wasn't that skilled in anything yet. I'd been working for a few years, but I wasn't a pro at anything. So I'm looking for work. And I guess I got to a point where I realized there is so much more knowledge to be had. And I'm limiting this search for a job to this tiny little fraction of the world's knowledge base that I can kind of fit into. I had this heart to heart with my father, and he's not the one for heart to heart. He's not like a cold man. He's very warm, but we've never just had a moment like this. And he was always in the back of his mind thinking I should go into architecture. He thought it'd be great for me. And, that's where he got his degree from Pratt, actually, coincidentally, because that's where I got my design degree. Yeah, he had this heart-to-heart with me, and he's just, like, pushing me. He's like, you should look into architecture at the very least. And I started looking into it, and then along the way, I discovered this field that, at the time, I think our entire society just took for granted, industrial design. That I was obsessed with this idea that the things around us, every single thing you're staring at right now, was created by people, and they put time and effort and strategy and problem solving into all of these things.
That's an exciting moment. I mean, I remember growing up not knowing what the hell industrial design was, and then I figured it out and I was like, oh my God, what?
Yeah.
This is amazing.
There's this like mentality that like everything just comes off of a conveyor belt magically and ends up in source, you know, and that's the furthest thing from the truth because, you know, it could take you a year and a half to develop a wine glass, you know?
Yeah, and it totally devalues the object and the humans that make them. And I think that's one of the reasons Amy and I were so passionate about talking to designers, because we really want people to understand how much work really goes into making a product. It doesn't just pop out of a factory machine and, yeah, get boxed up and shipped to your house. Like, there's a labor of love.
Absolutely. And there are so many people on board doing so many different things just to get a product into the market. You know, I've worked on seating collections that took 3-4 years. And at the end of the day, it looks simple. It looks effortless. But a lot of people struggled to get it to that point.
Your heart to heart with your father is kind of what convinced you to look at architecture. And through looking at architecture, you found industrial design. And is that what led you to go get a master's at Pratt?
That was it. I looked at a few different schools and Pratt just spoke to me for some reason. And I took a few courses to get into the program, some design and drawing courses. And then, yeah, I spent the next 2.5 years there getting a master's degree.
And was it a click, like a major resonant click? Did you know when you started studying industrial design that this was a good fit for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, all the things in the past kind of led me to this. I'm not a believer in that. You know, my mom's the believer in that. You know, everything happens for a reason. I don't believe it, but for some reason it happened and I found what I think satisfies me more than any other career ever could.
So 2.5 years at grad school, and then you're popped out onto the streets of Manhattan as a designer. What do you do then? How did you go from being a student to a professional?
I got a phone call. I had submitted some work online early on to some design blogs when design blogs just started kind of coming out. I got a phone call from a creative director at L'Oreal. And this is right at the time when I was putting a portfolio together, wondering what the hell I'm going to do. Where am I going to work? This guy calls me up and he says, we saw some of your work and we like, you know, the way you think. Do you want to come in for a meeting? And I came into a meeting. My first client was L'Oreal. And I worked with them for about a year and a half. Some of their sub brands, Maybelline and Redken and Shu Uemura.
Designing packaging?
Packaging, cosmetics. You know, it wasn't something I was passionate about, but I was learning, you know, and I was getting my feet wet and I was getting paid well for the work I was doing. That kind of afforded me the ability to just pull the trigger and start my studio.
Cheers to L'Oreal for getting you kind of primed and ready. What were some of the other professional milestones that came along after that? And as is my experience, usually with growth like that also comes some hard-fought real-life lessons that are ultimately beneficial, but at the time feel really scary. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's always an uphill battle. You know, it doesn't matter what part of your career, what stage you're in, it's an uphill battle. The people around you have every reason to say no, because it's not just about you and your skill set. It's about the businesses that they're running and the strategies that they're creating for their businesses. But, you know, early on, I had some pretty unique and amazing things happen. I was interning for Karen Rashid early on, and Wallpaper magazine featured me as one of 10 up and coming designers in the world. This was in 2005. And for all I know, the journalist who wrote the article pointed from the phone book and found my name. I have no idea, but press follows press in a lot of cases. And that started to give my reputation a little bit of a buzz. And from there, I was contacted by Lin Rose, which is one of the greatest brands on the planet out of France. Started working with them within, I'd say, about a year and a half of starting my studio. I've had people support me along the way. Jerry Helling, who's the president of Bernhardt Design, he really took an interest in me and my work very early on. You can't do this in a vacuum. No designer can do this in a vacuum by themselves. It takes a village, you know? And the village that I had, I thank God every day that I had them, because they helped me to build this career that I absolutely love.
Do you feel like that village is mostly cobbled together from people you've met in your professional life? I know some people come out of school with a network of collaborators that kind of go off to do their own thing, but you still have this school-based network of alumni you can rely on. Do you have both?
No, my network was never built around anyone at Pratt. I knew that I had to meet everybody there is to meet and learn very quickly, you know, who I got along with and who I saw eye to eye with. So, you know, in the case of Lin Rose, I was still a grad student and I started talking to somebody at ICFF. I think it was the last year they actually showed there. Jessica Cairncross, who, you know, climbed the ladder of the company over the years. And eventually she showed my work to Antoine Rose, who runs the North American operations for the brand. Then I got a phone call from them maybe 3 years later, but it was just that persistence and that, you know, let me show you what I do. Let me show you that I'm worthy of working with you kind of mentality. And a lot of it is just fake it till you make it. You know, I pretended I should be in front of all the people that I put myself in front of, even though I had no reason and no right to. Some people reacted to me and reacted to my work and how I talked about design and how I felt about design. And so my network was entirely based on me going out there and meeting people, meeting them at the design fairs in Milan and Stockholm and in Paris, and just kind of being part of that scene that I wanted to be part of. And now the network extends to, you know, designers all over the world who I follow and who follow me, and we see each other and we reunite every design fair there is, and manufacturers and PR people. And, you know, it's just this amazing community of people who are passionate about one thing.
Are there any instances in which that aggressive networking kind of backfired or didn't serve you as well as you thought it would that turned out to be a lesson you could use constructively going forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's instances in which you build a rapport with people and you think this is good. This is kind of, you know, going to lead to something big, I think. And they tell you the same. And it just never happens. And you're wondering, you know, well, what is it? What's the reasoning? You know, why isn't it happening? And you get down on yourself and you say, am I good enough? Are there just that many people better than me? What's the issue, you know? And a lot of the times it's just bad timing.
Yeah. Or they have a set of circumstances they're dealing with that have nothing to do with you. They don't want to burn that bridge. So they keep you on the line because they don't know. Maybe it will come to fruition and they're going to need you at some point.
Exactly. When I was younger, I took it to heart. I mean, I was such an emotional wreck over it. I thought I was just being dumped every single time somebody said, oh, you know?
Sweet young Brad Ascalon getting That's rough.
It's rough. But you know what? You eventually learn the reason is not me. Hopefully. Hopefully it is. It is some back end stuff that you're not privy to. You need thick skin. You know, if you don't have insanely thick skin, you can't do what we do. You can't do what designers are doing because, you know, you get rejected a lot and you just have to roll with it and you have to learn from it. And even when you're midway through a project or almost done a project and last minute, the project doesn't launch for some reason, you can't take it personally. You can't burn your bridges. You have to accept it. You have to accept that this is a reality of what we do. 11, 12 years into your career, if you still feel like you're getting dumped every time somebody says no, then find a different career, I'd say.
You can't take it personally. And that's a real skill, a tool in your toolbox. But then you also have to be sensitive enough to take in the impressions that the world can have on you in order to generate new inventions and ideas that nobody's seen or thought of before. It's a real intermingling of this ability to not take things personally and yet maximize your sensitivity. And so that brings me to your creative process. And you do so many different types of products. You work in so many different materials and processes and product categories. Is there any consistency to your process? Can you isolate like what it starts with and where does it go?
I like to think of myself as a rational designer, not an emotional one. My projects tend to begin with either some strategic brief from a client and some needs that need to be met. I don't tend to put poetry and symbolism, whatnot, into my work too often. Or on the other end, there's some desire to explore a new way to think about the objects that we use, you know, that we take for granted, perhaps, you know, this is how X is done, but, you know, what other ways can we accomplish the same thing, the same functionality? So it kind of starts there. You know, when I was in grad school, we'd have teachers who would tell us to pick an object out of a hat, you know, a little piece of paper, and you open it up and it says, oh, CD player. And then you pick an animal out of another hat, an octopus, and you have to design an octopus-inspired CD player. And that's not real. That's not how the real world works. And that's not how I work as a designer. And some people are great at it. Some people are just, they think ultra conceptually and they've made great careers out of it. But, you know, I'm a rationalist. What's necessary? And I think the best designers will just completely deconstruct the objects around them so that they can build them back up in a completely unique way and a new way of thinking about it. We just did a recent project with Other, it's a candle holder. And historically, the candle goes into a hole in some material. That's the support that the candle gets when you light it. And we don't need that hole. We need 3 points. You know, we need 3 points that the candle can't escape this little pocket of air. The idea is it's as much as it needs to be and as little as it can be kind of simultaneously, you know, and that for me is like this reductive process. Does what I'm doing add to the functionality of a design? Is it perhaps a detail that's necessary, you know, from a manufacturing or engineering perspective? Is it integral to the concept, you know, and if it's not, I eliminate it. I think there are kind of two different types of designers in the world. There's the
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, clever listeners. We're getting excited for New York Design Week in May. This year will be better than ever. ICFF, North America's leading platform for contemporary design, will take place from May 19th to the 21st at the Javits Center in New York City. I'll be there, and I'm excited to let you know how Clever is collaborating with ICFF for Launchpad at Wanted, formerly known as Wanted Design Manhattan, and the Emerging Designer Showcase. Launchpad is an international platform for emerging designers that introduces new concepts and showcases prototypes of furniture, home accessories, and lighting. It is the best place for manufacturers to meet new designers, discover fresh ideas, and potential products to develop. The best of Launchpad winners will be selected by a jury of renowned industry professionals, led by yours truly. And they will go on to be featured in another edition of the popular Emerging Designers Showcase. I'll be leading the Emerging Designers Showcase live on the Talks main stage, where the five Launchpad finalists will have a chance to present their projects to our esteemed panel of professionals. It's always a really good time. So mark your calendars for Sunday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Both Launchpad and the Emerging Designer Showcase are presented with media partners Clever, that's us, and Design Milk, and with support from American Standard and Lumens. Visit ICFF.com to learn more and register to attend. Those are the letters ICFF.com. Come by and say hi. I would love to see you there. Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
The rationalists and then the stylists. And not to say one is better than the other, but I kind of fall to one side. Does that make any sense whatsoever?
It does. I was just thinking about your process because you were mentioning reductive, but then also deconstructing the object.
I think the main point is design as a stylistic exercise is, to me, just a very mundane behavior. You know, it's a mundane endeavor. And, you know, I'll be honest, I do it when I have to, when a client's just in need of something kind of aesthetically one direction or another. But that's not what really does it for me. You know, I love beautiful things just as much as the next person, right? Probably more because I'm a designer. But it's the way in which that beautiful object happens. You know, it's how the designer finds a beautiful solution that's intriguing to me. If they set out to create this beautiful object, you know, so what? That's uninteresting. If the result of all the other things, if, you know, the obstacles, the manufacturing process, the material challenges, the client, their budgets, the marketing needs, if all of that gets kind of thrown into the hopper and the result is beautiful, that to me is good design. That's design that excites me. You know, it's design that could be reduced to my point earlier, exactly as much as it needs to be while simultaneously kind of as little as it can be, you know?
Right. And like the form of the object as being a beautiful thing is not the driving factor, certainly not the point of focus for you or the starting point. It's more like, you know, can I meet all of these criteria? And can I also maybe change the form in a way that functions better or differently. And in the end, it's attractive.
Yeah, I mean, the form is going to be the result of lots of other things. I mean, it's Louis Sullivan 101, you know, form follows function. We kind of can push and pull that a little more than we used to be able to because of technology and possibilities that exist now that didn't. But yeah, I think that's exactly right.
We'll be back with Brad in a few.
Support for Clever comes from Parachute. Listen to me. Can you hear how well-rested I sound? I got amazing sleep last night, and today I'm pretty much invincible. I just got linen bed sheets from Parachute, and they are everything. It's getting warmer here in Los Angeles, so nighttime temperature regulation is key. And they are so light, airy, and breathable, I feel like I'm sleeping in a cloud of unicorn whispers. They're soft and crisp at the same time, which means they feel good on my skin without the suffocating clinginess of heavier sheets that makes me feel like I'm buried alive. And they are all natural, non-toxic, produced with a small eco footprint, and more affordable than you'd think. All important ingredients for excellent dreams. The only question is, top sheet or no top sheet? I'm a top sheet kind of girl, but I know plenty of people who prefer to go topless. Parachute understands that, and so they sell the top sheet separately. You do you. You can find out all about their linen, percale, and sateen sheets at parachutehome.com.
Support for Clever also comes from Benchmade Modern. Buying a sofa that fits your room and your taste is such a hassle. You waste a ton of time on trips to multiple showrooms, there are almost no customization options, and you'll wait 12 plus weeks for your sofa to arrive. Benchmade Modern feels your pain and has your solution. They make affordable, custom-sized modern sofas in days, not months. Choose your perfect style from their collections, decide on your custom dimensions and configuration, pick your fabric and leg color, and then you're done. They'll make your sofa in 14 days or less. Yeah, that's right. They'll make a custom sofa in 2 weeks or less. To start designing your dream sofa, go to benchmademodern.com to order free swatches. Use the code CLEVER and take 15% off your order.
So with regard to your process, I'm imagining you ideating and rendering and going back and forth to clients and manufacturing facilities and sort of overseeing the prototyping. Do I have that right? Because you don't have your own workshop where you're actually prototyping a lot yourself, right? You kind of have to do that through your clients.
Yeah, exactly. There are times when I have little details made and sketch models and whatnot built. But I'm glad I don't prototype on my own. You know, I'd rather leave that to the professionals because they're the ones who are going to learn about certain limitations when it comes to production. And they're going to teach me those obstacles along the way so we can kind of overcome them and problem solve them together. But to your point, yeah, while I'm not like physically engaging in making prototypes, you know, I go to the factories I work with. I get my hands just as dirty as, you know, all the other guys who are working in the factory. And, you know, I have to be there to see how things are done so I can, you know, understand the materials, the processes, their limitations and the challenges involved.
So I know for me, sometimes the actual physical act of making something also somehow like loosens my brain up to arrive at solutions. So do you have a hands-on activity that you can do in your studio? I mean, is it music?
Yeah, it's music. I play my piano. I have a piano here in my studio, and I have a few guitars here. And I like to take a half hour a day when I just get to this point where creativity is not flowing. And it's kind of my meditation. It's like I forget about all of these challenges that I'm facing every day and all these deadlines and obstacles, and I just play. And when I come out of that, I can just start fresh and go be creative again, or at least attempt to be.
I don't know what it is, but there is something sort of magical about your brain and your hands and your heart kind of all working together on something that kind of doesn't matter in the moment. You know, something's just sort of loose and free that tends to sort of jog things that are stuck.
Yeah, of course. It's a reason why people meditate. My brothers both meditate and they started getting me into it. And I wish I had the discipline to continue with it. But I would be in the middle of my living room, just in the middle of a little private meditation center. And then all of a sudden, the bar cart that I'm designing, like this problem I've been trying to figure out for 2 months, just boom, it just pops into my head. You can't solve these problems when you're trying to solve these problems. You know, it doesn't happen that way. It happens when it's unexpected, when your brain just allows itself to loosen up and not be so strict and stringent, you know?
Yeah. Thinking too hard almost always prevents the actual solution from coming to you.
Luckily for me, I've got a lot of ways to escape that. My newest one, I just got a whittling set from my wife's grandmother for my birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you like carving spoons and stuff?
I'm going to start.
All right.
I'm going to start. Yeah, I got this amazing like high-end whittling set, and I'm going to sit and start to whittle because maybe there's more I can learn out of that, you know?
You got to make yourself a corncob pipe.
I'm going to make you a corncob pipe. That's the first thing.
I will take it. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, I'll smoke the shit out of that.
The funniest thing is I opened this box and I got all these whittling tools and it comes with a package of Band-Aids. I'm like, shit.
So, part of the process, sorry.
Yeah, just
safety first.
I don't want to lose any digits.
You're probably going to go down this crazy YouTube hole of like whittling videos.
I do that right now. My birthday just happened.
How many years young?
All of them.
Good answer. Because you're my age. Good answer.
My wife bought me the guitar of my dreams.
What'd you get?
I got this gorgeous Martin, this parlor style guitar. It's my dream. That's it. It's just the dream guitar. And I've been recently obsessed with bluegrass, not because I've always loved bluegrass, because it is the perfect music for this guitar. And so I'm obsessed with YouTube videos and I'm watching 50 different people a day learning all these riffs. And now I'm learning some bluegrass music, which I'm very psyched about.
I'm psyched about that, too, because I think YouTube is continuing education for everyone.
Absolutely. You don't need to pay for anything. You don't need to pay for guitar lessons. Just YouTube it.
You can learn how to skin a coyote if you want to. It's amazing.
That's another hobby I'm getting into.
Oh, great. All right. So let's delve into your personal life a little bit, mostly because I think a lot of our listeners hear somebody who sounds so successful and we need to deconstruct that a little bit. And you can relate to the idea of deconstruction in order to figure out what makes something tick or how it works. And it's only human to have some demons that you have to face down on the regular. What are yours?
That's hard to answer.
Yeah, I know it's a tough question.
Oh my God, you're going to make me think. You're going to make me break down and cry.
It's okay. It's a safe space.
I don't know that I've got too many demons, you know? I mean, for the sake of the question, I wish I did. I'm kind of glad I don't. You know, if there was one demon, it is always kind of that, what we already discussed, you know, that getting rejected by clients, but that's a work question. That's not a personal life question.
It sort of translates though, because the rejection you feel ends up feeling personal. You have had to learn how to work through that and not feel rejected or not take things personally. It's a real existential thing to tackle.
Well, thank you.
I mean, if we wanted to get super deep, we could probably find somewhere in your early childhood that relates back to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think everybody's kind of built from their previous experiences. And, you know, I'm sure I was teased along the way and that led me to one direction versus another.
Well, I mean, if you think about the idea of rejection or being afraid of rejection or just, you know, having to learn how to deal with it. I mean, yeah, you're designing projects, but you're the one who's designing them. So it is very personal. I mean, your studio is primarily you for the most part at the end of the day. So it reflects on you. And sometimes, you know, as a small business owner or a designer, it crosses over. You know, it's hard to separate like business stuff from personal stuff. At least that has been my experience as a small business owner. It is hard not to take things personally.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's not like, you know, I shut my door at 6:30 p.m. and I forget about everything that happened that day, you know? I mean, that's like the good and the bad about this kind of industry. It's like designers are always thinking about work. They're always thinking about making things better. They're always problem solving. They're always playing out every step they take in life. They're playing that out in their heads. And so you can never really turn off. I guess that's one of those things that is so hard to do. It's, you know, you're closed shop for the weekend and you're at a restaurant and the door handle suggests that you pull it and you try to pull it, but you're supposed to push it. And it's just like, my God, design needs to be better than this, you know? And you see the entire world from that perspective. I mean, you know, when my wife and I registered for gifts for our wedding, oh my God, she wanted to kill me because I would refuse to accept a bottle opener. I would refuse to accept a can opener, like all these silly little things, a sponge, like, because it's not designed as well as it can be, you know? And she almost murdered me.
Oh my gosh. I got into a fight with Jordan one time because I took too long looking at sponges in the sponge aisle because I couldn't decide which sponges would look the best with my kitchen. Like, he was like literally ready to get divorced.
It makes total
just pick
sense.
A fucking sponge.
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, there doesn't need to be 50 freaking sponges, you know?
They should all be beautiful.
So sponges aside, do you also try to problem solve your life and your relationships?
I don't know, maybe in small doses. Over the past maybe 4 or 5 years, I've learned to separate work from life a lot better. I used to work 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. You know, that's what I had to do for a long time. And I learned to separate one from the other. And now I can end the day. And if I've got an email or two to get back on, that's one thing. But I think the separation is necessary in making me better at what I do and making me understand the problems that I'm facing and the challenges that I'm trying to design for.
I have a question for you about your sense of purpose, because earlier you mentioned that you weren't a big believer in like things that were meant to be, but you know, your mom is. Is there a reason why, or do you ever feel like I am being pulled in this one direction, or the universe is telling me that this is where I'm supposed to be, or any of that stuff? Or is it just like mumbo jumbo?
No, it's like I believe in science and rationality. You know, I believe we're kind of all part of this giant chemical and biological petri dish, you know, without reason or purpose. But that's not to say we can't create our own purpose and meaning, you know, out of the randomness of it. If I could create that path on my own, I'm certainly doing it. I don't think there's somebody above playing chess and making me a better designer or making me, you know, get the work that I'm getting. I just don't buy it. But I definitely I know what I want, and I want what I want out of it. And so I'm going to keep working towards that, you know.
So you believe that, like, if you set a path for yourself, then if you like check all these boxes, then you're going to get to where you need to get. It's not like this thing where you're waiting for a sign or, I don't know.
I'll say this. All I know is that I follow a path that I think is going to get me where I want to be, and that where I want to be changes. You know, my track has changed a few times already since I started my studio 11 years ago. And maybe it will change again, but it's not going to happen simply because I'm following all these rules or these, you know, prescribed kind of paths.
Is your personal track and your professional track the same, or how are they intertwined? Or do you have something different you envision for yourself down the line, like personally?
No, I think, you know, my career is such a big part of my life, and it's my, you know, biggest love aside from my wife and my dog. It is my life, you know, I mean, for designers and artists and chefs and, you know, it is your life. This is the life you were kind of made to build for yourself or whatnot. And you can't kind of separate those two. I mean, you can say, I'm not going to work on weekends, like, you know, I'm right. Not going to work late at night, but they're so integral to one another, you know. More than that, you know, the fact that the people in my life, you know, my wife has become my best critic. She's become that person who now is looking at the world the way I do. Even though she's not a designer, she finds those faults and those flaws in the design world. And so because there's this connection that we've got personally, and there's this understanding that she now has of me professionally, you can't separate those.
What is your path? I don't want to ask you, like, how do you see yourself in 5 years? But, like, I want to ask you, where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years? I don't know.
Time will tell. I do know that I am now at a point where the scale of the projects that I'm working on are much more massive and exciting and potentially extremely effective than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. You know, at first, you're not given the chance to help change a company. You're just designing objects, hoping they get produced. But, you know, I'm 11 years into my studio, and the projects I'm getting are massive. They take a lot of investment on the parts of my clients. And it's very exciting that I get to be a part of a changing company. I get to actually have a say and have a stake in a strategy that's been developed, you know. That's ultimately, right now at least, that's the most exciting thing in the world for me. You know, it's the fact that I'm trusted to this point where I'm handed the keys to this enormous project that will take 3-4 years. But at the end of it, we can actually make some significant dent in the market, you know, down the road. I don't know. You know, I do know that there are certain things, that the goals that I have for myself, that are outside of the world of design. I'm at this place where I'm where I should be right now. You know, I'm small. I don't have a big studio. I don't want a big studio. I've got a nice little network of freelancers when the need arises. You know, if I could grow it to 3-4 people and run it in that way, maybe I'll do that one day. I don't find the need right now, or the desire. It's been years in the making, kind of creating the job that I want for myself, and it'll change when I want it to, when I need it to. I don't want to force like the growth, you know, more so than I have to.
You mentioned personal goals that are separate from work. What's still on the list to be tackled? Are we talking, you know, a lake home in Italy or children or an empire?
An empire. I want to castle south of France.
Yes.
No, we just we did just buy a vacation house, my wife and I, on the North Fork of Long Island, which is like heaven. It's quiet. It's peaceful. There's farms and wineries and water in every direction. You know, I constantly toy with the idea of leaving Manhattan for good. I've been here for 17 years. You know, I'm officially a New Yorker. And every day I both love and hate the city more than I did the previous day. You know,
the feelings are just getting more intense.
Exactly. The personal goal isn't actually like getting up and leaving. It's simply coming to grips with that question. Do I love it more or do I hate it more? You know, And I think if I had an answer, at the very least, I'd be satisfied with that. But I romanticize just getting up and leaving the city and moving to the North Fork for good and, you know, having a great life there, building my studio there. But, you know, the truth is my industry's here. It's in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not out there.
Yeah. Where are you going to do your whittling and your bluegrass playing though? It feels like a cabin or a vacation house is a great place to do that.
That's where I'm going to be doing
that's
that.
The dream.
Yeah. I'm actually building a little shop in the basement so I can, you know, make things that I don't, you know, living in Manhattan, I don't have that luxury of having a functioning shop. So I get to do all those other things that I don't do here. I still don't think I'll ever leave the city. You know, my wife works here, her career's here, and yeah, so that personal goal you asked about, it's just, I guess, dealing with my thoughts about this city for once and for all. But I don't think that'll ever happen. I will say, though, like when you go away for a weekend, when you're nice and relaxed, and then you come back to the city feels amazing again. And then come Thursday, you're like, oh, my God, I need to get out. It's a symbiotic relationship, you know, city mouse, country mouse, you know.
No, but I think it's a nice balance between having everything you love about the city, but being able to leave if you need to get away. Yeah.
Yeah. That being said, I think this is the greatest city in the world still. You know, I can't refute that. It would be tough to leave it.
So you mentioned you're working on bigger and more exciting projects. Do you have like a particular project that you want our listeners to take note of or be excited about?
We're doing a lot of work in Scandinavia right now with some great companies, some of them ongoing for two or three plus years now. That I'll tell you, you'll probably know more about in the fall. There are more recent things that we're working on. I know that you're probably familiar with Pablo Lighting out in San Francisco. We're launching our first project together, which is some lighting. After Milan, it'll be here at ICFF, and then the trade show circuit, NeoCon in Chicago. I'm doing some new contract seating with a couple companies. Yeah, I wish I could talk about more right now, but
top secret.
But it's, you know, I'm sworn to secrecy. You know, they know where I live.
Well, when these projects are not secret, I'm sure you'll be promoting them on the web and social media. So where can our listeners find you there to follow your work?
So my website is www. Do I have to even say that anymore?
No, I don't think so.
No, just, you age yourself when you say the W.
So they can go onto the information superhighway. And go to www.bradascalon.com, BRADASCALON.com. And my handle on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram is BradAskNYC, BRADASCNYC.
Okay, well, we'll tell our listeners to get on there and find you on the Instagram so they can see all your cool stuff and your whittling. We expect to see a lot of whittling, maybe some bluegrass playing.
Maybe some Band-Aids along the way.
Can I look for my pipe sometime toward the fall? Fall is pipe smoking weather, so that would be ideal for me. Timeline work for you?
Summer is corn weather.
Okay, great.
So I'll eat the corn, I'll dry the corn husk, and I'll whittle you a little corn pipe.
You know, what's really funny about this corn conversation is Brad sent me a necklace made out of corn.
Oh, my God.
One day I just got this random package in the mail, and it was this necklace made out of little pieces of dried corn.
I completely forgot about that. I think I got that in Mexico. Because like you love like really funky, awesome jewelry.
I do.
And I just saw this and I was like, you know, Jamie would love this. I think I was in Mexico. I was in like in Tulum or something.
I think it came with a note that was like, I got you a corny present.
Oh my God. Thanks for admitting that to your listeners.
Well, you know, now they know you have a sense of humor too. So that's good.
That's like a joke my mother-in-law would have told.
Oh, it's a dad joke. You start telling them after you get into your 30s and then they just get worse over time. Thank you, Brad. It's been awesome talking to you. I'm glad we are able to talk in a little more depth about you and your work, because normally we don't get to do that when we see each other. So it's been awesome chatting with you. And I'm really excited to see the new stuff with Pablo.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And so we'll follow up with you for those footsteps MP3s, because we're going to need some of those for our show notes.
Are there any YouTube videos?
Oh, my God.
I'm YouTubing you tonight.
I'd send you a cassette and a CD, but I don't even know if you have those objects to play them anymore.
I can't handle a cassette, but I could work with a CD.
Oh, good. All right.
Well, thank you. This has been really fun.
Awesome, guys. Thank you so much.
Oh, he's he's a great guy.
He is a great guy. He's a hardworking, dedicated soldier of design.
Yeah, I like his approach to design because, you know, we talked to a lot of designers and we're like, where's your inspiration? And they're like, oh, well, I saw a petal floating in the wind and it, you know, made me draw this curve.
We don't talk to anybody who says that shit.
You know what I mean? Like, that's... I've done so many designer interviews and okay. We do talk to people like that, but that's fine. I mean, that's cool. That's where they get their inspiration. But Brad is like, he's very practical. And what I appreciate about his honesty and in his approach is like, he really just looks at the brief and really takes it seriously. Like, okay, these are the things we need to hit. Like, these are the boxes I need to check. And, you know, I'm going to make something that is functional and hopefully it ends up being beautiful. But, you know, he gets really focused on the actual like design process. I like that he does this reductive process.
I like that he's in tune with his rational side and that he very much espouses this idea of rational design. But I'm going to argue that there is an ineffable that he doesn't quite know how to master it because he doesn't have control over it. And therefore, he doesn't talk about it. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, because his work is not without formal beauty.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he said he's like the biggest design nerd and he won't even like buy a bottle opener unless it's like beautiful.
Right.
I think he has an eye. I just feel like it's so subconscious for him that he doesn't focus on that part. He focuses on all the other parts.
So we're saying the same thing. It's just that it's subconscious. And because it's not conscious, he doesn't give it as much credit as he might if he had some sort of control over it.
Yeah, I mean, because he grew up around artists. So he's always been looking at form and been involved in sculptural beauty. So I think it's just part of his DNA.
Yeah, that's probably what it is in terms of manipulating notes and sounds with music and in terms of like bringing something forward from nothing. He's an architect in that regard, right? And he's very, very in tune with his practical thinking.
You could argue, and I'm going to become the armchair psychiatrist for a moment.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
He mentioned that he was trying to go into business school to fight against being what his father was, which is completely artistic, right? Because he said his mom worked on managing the studio because his dad was just like super creative. And I just wonder if he's still doing that. Like he's fighting against the idea of starting with the beauty and the form and the artistic aspect of it. And so he's focusing on the strategic part of it.
I think you're onto something. The good news is
I have a PhD in bullshit, Amy. So.
Yeah. But the good news is whether he feels like he's rational and practical or a poet and a musician, he does manage to bring all of that together into beautiful objects. So, and he's doing that
he's
exceedingly well.
It.
I think you should write him a prescription from your armchair psychologist.
Oh, yes. Please whittle 25 corncob pipes and learn 5 bluegrass songs. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and sign up for our newsletter, read the show notes, and see images of Brad's work and his rockin' band Footsteps at cleverpodcast.com.
And if you'd like to help support Clever, here are 5 easy ways. You can forward our newsletter to people who might be interested. You can make a donation on cleverpodcast.com. You can tell your friends, especially friends who aren't already in the design field. You can repost your favorite Clever quote on Instagram. And you can support our sponsors. Use the special offer code that we mentioned in the ads. Connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Clever Podcast. We always love to hear from you.
This episode of Clever was edited by Chris Modal of Your Studio with music by L1011.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.